judges Thanksgiving Day's success by how little of significance is ultimately accomplished. No cleanup. That waits until the day after. No deep conversations, no politics, no religion, no sports even. Absolutely nothing of any seriousness at all besides eating. To be fair to her, she's also quite concerned about the initial appearance of her hospitality, as in when her guests arrive, she ushers them through her house and points out just the right tablecloths that she elected, the right plates for the platter, her most festive of napkins, and her most opulent yet unedible dessert. As she understands it, Thanksgiving is a day where she can and ought to retreat from the world, wine and dine with her closest friends and family, engaging in what amounts to an incestuous delight of hedonistic ingestion, devouring everything in sight, except that undignified, ribbed cranberry sauce that her crazy aunt still insists on bringing. But outside of that regrettable addition to the table, the rest of the table and the rest of the day better look good and behave well and require as little effort as possible. Does this sound like anyone that you know? No? It wasn't like your Thanksgiving. Does this sound a bit like our church family, perhaps? I find that I am composed of two parts, left and right, and sometimes one part of me is honest and candid. It feels that we are a bit more like the Chestnut Hill Country Club than the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill. A private club where we can retreat from the outside world, occupying ourselves with only each other's company, not really taking seriously the visitors who come in, nor the strangers who are out on the avenue. After we culminate a serious hour of worship in this sanctuary, we run off to enjoy high coffee, discussing all matters of our lives that have nothing to do with the significance of the hour we previously spent, and we only do so in our little circles of familiarity. Moreover, we dress up coffee hour such that we have the best cookies and the best Danish, not from our own ovens, but from Redmond's. And Lord forbid if anything ever looks less than excellent or a little out of place. Lord forbid if that rib can ever end up here at Chess Press. And so we go on later in the week, and we hire out professionals to do the flowers outside because, you know, we have to keep up appearances. And so we order wine and cheese, and we announce from this pulpit that we order wine and cheese at every occasion, no matter the event or the gravity of the cause, because why else would you come if there wasn't wine and cheese? And so we go on, resorting to gambling over cocktails, playing Texas Hold'em poker, to fundraise for our youth summer mission trip. I don't know, my friends, I think that this part of me, I think that Ezekiel has this part of us pinned down pretty well. Namely that we are the fat, sheep, gluttons for our own interests, accomplishing little in the way of substance, ingesting as much as we can such that only the scraps get sent off to the lean, to the shelters. That's one part. The other part of me celebrates just how much we do get right here. Even with our visible bumps and observable bruises, we are yet family. Moreover, we are a beacon for the arts in this city. We are the epicenter of community down in the center on the hill. We are annual sponsors for countless organizations whose collective purpose is to promote welfare for the needy and justice for the silenced. Laura just mentioned one. All of this and so much more is absolutely true of our ministry here. It is absolutely. And I think sometimes we consider all of the good work, all the hard work that we've done, and I think we sometimes wonder, are we really not entitled to enjoy some of these gifts just for ourselves? ourselves, even just a little. The music and the pageantry, the cookies, the wine, the drapery. Do we really have to always think first of those who have less? I mean, Jesus has got to be just a little bit reasonable here, right? Just a little. Then the righteous one answered him, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty or stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? Then Jesus will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. Maybe not so reasonable, but I'm going to try. I do believe that we can take care of the least of these without also sacrificing everything ourselves. After all, if we did sacrifice everything, then we too would become the least of these, and someone would then have to take care of us and our starving children and our children's starving children, and the cycle would never end. So no, we probably don't need to upend our lifestyle so completely, though a little more certainly wouldn't hurt, such that we have nothing left on our table besides that which was given by others. But I do think we need to amend and qualify just what it means to take care of our other, these least of these. I think it starts by pivoting from thinking that all of our mission partners' needs can be remedied simply by writing another check. Checks are important. Even if we write a larger check at that, how much effort does the act of writing a check actually entail? It's a stroke of the pen. I think Jesus is imploring us to do something more than just write checks from afar. I think Jesus is imploring us to leave the comforts of our houses, our circles, our tables, surrounded by the familiar faces and family, and to go to the outermost fringes in our society, the hospitals, the prisons, even the streets, to listen and to share, and not just our stuff, our money, just throwing it at them, but our lives. To share our lives. For it is only there in fellowship with our other that we will truly take care of and encounter the Anointed One. This past Sunday, the youth group in the afternoon went to worship at West Kensington Ministry. We had been there several times before, and each time it's been different. Last Sunday was no exception. But Don, their pastor, called it this will be a service of sharing. What that meant was that anyone from the crowd, not the pastor, was to come up to the pulpit and preach the sermon that day. Should we do that here? And so after the hymns ended, a man named John shimmied forward. His clothes were dirty. They were worn. He had tattoos up and down his arms, up and down his legs, several on his neck, and one right by his eye. He spoke with a stammer, or perhaps a drunken stupor. His sermon, truth be told, was a rambling mess of largely disconnected ideas. But they all had a central focus, if you listen hard enough, forgiveness. And so he shared his story for us. I'll share a little bit for you. His biological father left his mother before he was born. Another man moved in some years later. This other man physically abused him, throwing him through walls in fits of anger, and one time kicked his head so hard into the floor that it spilled out into a pool of blood. This man introduced John to cocaine at the age of six. Six. At 10, John himself started to use cocaine at the bequest of this man. His sister, a couple years later, was fatally stabbed in front of him, her torso disemboweled in front of his own eyes, a robbery. As you can imagine, John's life went haywire. He fell into depression, he moved out to the streets, he was homeless. The only solace purpose he thought God was talking to him. He then began reading Scripture front to back and back to front, such that in this service of sharing, he was able to recite passages at will by memory. Ultimately, he came to believe that God had forgiven him for all of his crimes, and thus it was now his turn to forgive others, even himself and even his enemies, even this father figure man. So he approached this man and introduced him to cocaine, who kicked his head and threw him through walls, and he said, "I forgive you." And it was through that unfathomable event of grace, redemption, and charity that the gospel of Christ became fully realized within him, and his life forever changed. When I was listening to this story, I couldn't help but see the presence of the Anointed One in him. In this kicked tin can of a human being, broken, disheveled, ribbed, discarded, the essence of the gospel was made real to me, more real, dare I say, than it is often made real here in this place, amongst the par excellence. When he was done sharing his story, John began to dance. When he was done dancing, he began to pray. And when he was done praying, he began to fellowship with each of us, shaking each of our hands, each of the youth's hands, and inquiring into each of their stories. He listened with such intent, with such earnest, that it's as if every word that we spoke about our own unimaginably different, privileged, affluent lives was yet of equal importance and relevance to his own. John, the least of these? Anything but. Most simply and obviously stated, this experience that I had, that the youth had, would never have happened if we also never left this place and showed up. If we just wrote another check from afar and went back to our homes and back to the golf courses, it was only through fellowship, face-to-face fellowship, that we were able to encounter John, his story, and indeed the presence of the risen Christ still working in this world, and miraculously so. Isn't this so wonderful, then, some of you must be thinking? How great that the youth were able to go to West Kensington and experience, have this experience with John there. What if John came through those doors here? John dressed like he was, loud and stuttering as he was, dancing throughout these pews as he was. What would we do? What would you do? Would you divert your eyes? Shake your head? Would you stare a little too long? Would we ask a frontier to go escort him back out to the streets? We end up like this Methodist church in Malibu. Did you read this story this week? A Methodist church in Malibu was asked by the town to stop serving meals to the homeless because it was lowering the needy. And they complied. Or would we be, unlike them, the good host, or better yet, the good servant, inviting John in to share our pews, our worship, even our table, our coffee, and our cookies? My friends, today is Christ the King's Sunday. And unlike every other king who would rather hobnob with the elite than the most glorious of society, the most decadent of tables, this King of Kings opens his banquet hall in the back alleyway of the grimiest neighborhood, sending out invitations to the crackheads, to the outcasts, and the sinners. And on and around Christ's banquet table, it's not the choicest of wines and silverware, but I'd wager some discarded, unwanted, ribbed fruit. And until we come to terms with that, until we begin to see what it really matters to be a part of this faith in action, until we begin to widen our eyes and open our arms to the sick, the incarcerated, and the downtrodden, we will forever remain blind to the truth, and I promise you the power of the gospel. help.